some antidepressants, and he says he's sleeping better. He likes the doctors, says the food is good. He'd rather stay there than in jail here. Why can't he get out, Jake?
We've had this conversation, Josie. He has been indicted for capital murder. Nobody gets bail in a case like this.
But what about school? He's 2 years behind anyway, and he's just sitting there losing ground every day. They won't put him in a class at Whitfield because he's a security risk and only temporary. Bring him back here to wait for trial, and they ain't got no tutors at the jail here. Why can't they send him to a juvenile facility somewhere, someplace where they at least make him go to class?
Because he's not being treated like a juvenile. As of now, he's an adult.
I know, adult. What a joke. He's just a little kid who's not even shaving yet. One of his counselors down there told me she'd never seen a 16-year-old boy as physically immature as Drew.
A pause as she wiped her red cheeks.
His father was like that. Just a kid.
Jake glanced at Meg, who glanced at Charles. Jake decided to dig a little. Who is his father? Josie laughed and shrugged and would have said, "What the hell?" But she was in a church.
A guy named Ray Barber. He was a boy down the road, and I sort of grew up with him. When we were 14, we started fooling around one day. One thing led to another, and we did it. Did it again and again, and we're having some fun. Didn't know a thing about birth control or basic biology. We were just a couple of stupid kids carrying on. I got pregnant at 15, and Ray wanted to get married. He was afraid he might get cut off. My mother sent me to live with an aunt in Shreveport to have the baby. I don't recall any discussion about terminating the pregnancy. I had the baby, and they wanted me to give it up. And I should have. I really should have. What I've put my kids through is nothing but a sin.
She took a deep breath, then a sip of water from a bottle.
Anyway, I remember Ray worrying because the other boys were shaving and getting hair on the legs, and he wasn't. He was afraid he was growing up late, like his father. Evidently, other parts were working okay.
What happened to Ray? Jake asked.
I don't know. I never went back home. When I wouldn't give up the baby, my aunt kicked me out. You know something, Jake? Getting pregnant at 15 was the worst mistake I ever made. It changed my life, and not for the better. I love Drew, same as I love Kira. But when a girl has a baby that young, her whole future is shot to hell. Pardon my language. The girl probably won't finish school. She probably won't marry well. She probably won't find a good job. She'll probably do what I did. Bounce from one bad man to another. That's why Kira is not having this baby, you understand, Jake? If I have to rob a bank to get the money for an abortion, I'll do it. She is not messing up her life. Hell, she didn't even want to have sex. I did. Pardon my language.
Charles shook his head and bit his lip, but said nothing. It was obvious, though, that he would have plenty to say about an abortion. Calmly, Jake said, "I understand, but this topic can be discussed at a later time. For now, I need to ask a question that has to be asked. She says Kofor is the father. Is there a chance there could be anyone else?" Nothing fazed Josie, not even the delicate suggestion that her young daughter might have been sleeping around. She shook her head no.
I ask her that. As you have probably noticed, she's normal for her age, a lot more mature than her brother. I know from experience what kids can do, so I ask her if there had been anybody else. She got upset at the question, said absolutely not, said Kofor was the first to ever touch her down there.
And this started around Christmas?
Yes. She said she was at the house by herself on a Saturday, right before Christmas.
Charles said, that would have been the 23rd of December.
I was at work. Drew was over at a friend's. Stu came home early and decided to go to her room. He said he wanted to do it. She said no, please, no. He forced himself on her, but was careful not to leave marks. When it was over, he said he'd kill her and Drew too if she ever told. He even asked her if she enjoyed it. Can you imagine? This happened several more times, 5 or 6 altogether, she thinks. And she says she was waiting for the right time to tell me. She says she couldn't keep on like that. Says she even thought about suicide. This is all my fault, Jake. See what I've done to my kids? All my fault.
She was sobbing again. Jake walked to the sink and poured out the cold coffee. He refilled his cup and walked to the door to look out. When her noises stopped, he returned to his seat and looked at her. A few more questions?
Sure. I'll tell you anything, Jake.
Do Drew and Kieran know they have different fathers?
No. I never told them. I figured they'd realize it soon enough. They look nothing alike.
Did Kofor physically abuse Drew?
Yes. He slapped him around, same for Kira, but never with his fists. He beat me several times, always when he was drunk. Sober Stu was okay, you know? But he was a crazy drunk. Very intimidating, though, drunk or sober.
Will you be able to take the witness stand and tell the jury about the physical abuse?
I suppose. I guess I'll have to, right?
Probably. Will Kira?
I don't know, Jake. Poor thing is a total wreck right now.
On cue, Kira appeared in the door and walked over to the table. Her eyes were puffy, her hair a mess. She wore baggy jeans and a sweatshirt, and Jake couldn't help but look at her stomach. He saw nothing suspicious. She smiled at him but didn't speak. She had a beautiful smile with perfect teeth, and Jake tried to imagine the horror of being a 14-year-old girl who had just learned that her body was carrying a child she wanted nothing to do with. Why does biology allow children to have children? Charles was saying, back to the trial. Any idea when it will take place? None whatsoever. It's still very early in the process. I know for minors who are tried as adults, the courts tend to move pretty fast. Maybe this summer, but I'm not sure.
The sooner the better, Josie said. I want this mess behind us.
It's not going away with a trial, Josie.
Oh, I know that, Jake,
she snapped.
It never goes away with me. Everything's a mess. Always has been, and I guess it always will be. I'm so sorry for this. The kids were begging me to leave Stu, and I wanted to. If I had known about him and Kira, we would have fled in the middle of the night. Don't ask me where, but we would have left. I'm just so sorry.
There was another long pause as everyone, Jake, Charles, Meg, and even Kira, tried to think of something to say that might be comforting. Josie said,
I didn't mean to be short, Jake. Please understand.
I do. It is imperative that this pregnancy be kept absolutely quiet. I'm sure you all get this, but the question is, how do we go about it? Kira is not in school, so we don't have to worry about her friends getting suspicious. What about folks around the church here? Charles said,
well, we'll have to tell Mrs. Golden, the tutor. She's already suspicious.
Can you handle that?
Sure.
Josie blurted,
well, after we get the abortion, we won't have to worry about it, will we?
Charles couldn't hold his tongue any longer and snapped, as long as you're living in this church, abortion is out of the question. If she gets one, then you'll have to leave.
We always leave. Jake, where's the nearest abortion clinic?
Memphis.
How much does one cost these days?
Don't know from experience, but I've heard it's something like $500.
Will you loan me $500?
I will not.
Okay. We'll get us another lawyer.
I'm not sure you can find another one.
Oh, there are plenty out there.
Charles said, everybody take a deep breath. It's been a long day, and nerves are frazzled. A moment passed. Jake took a last sip of coffee, rose, and walked back to the sink. He stepped to the end of the table and said, I need to be going, but I want you to think about a scenario that's hard to imagine. If there is an abortion, and I'm not in favor of one, but that's not my decision, then you not only destroy a life, but you also destroy valuable evidence. Carol will be called to testify at trial. If there is an abortion, she will not be permitted to mention it, nor should she, because of resentment among the jurors. She can tell the jury that Stuart Kofer raped her repeatedly, but other than her word, she cannot prove it. The police were never called. However, if she is obviously pregnant, or if she has already given birth, then the baby will be powerful evidence of Kofer's rapes. And Kira will create enormous sympathy, not only for herself, but, and more importantly, for her brother. Carrying the baby will be a huge factor in Drew's favor at trial.
So, she has the baby to save her brother?
Josie asked. Jake replied, she has the baby because it's the right thing to do. And it alone will not save her brother, but it could certainly help a very desperate cause.
She's too young to get stuck raising a kid,
Josie said. There are a lot of desperate and deserving couples, Josie, Jake said. I do 3 or 4 private adoptions a year, and they're my favorite cases.
What about its father? Not sure I'd want that gene pool.
Since when are we allowed to pick our parents? But Josie was shaking her head in disgust and disagreement. As Jake drove away, he was struck by the flashes of meanness that Josie had instinctively displayed. Not that he blamed her. She had been hardened by a life of bad choices and was desperate to provide something better for her children. She had probably gone the abortion route herself and was quietly thankful that she only had 2 kids to worry about. 2 were proving to be enough. He almost stopped at a country store for a beer, one for the road, a 16-ounce can of something ice cold that would take him about 20 minutes to savor. Then his car phone rang. It was Carla reminding him in clipped tones that they were supposed to leave the house in 30 minutes for dinner at the Atkavages. He had forgotten this. She had been calling for an hour. Where had he been? I can explain it all later, he said, and hung up. In his sensitive cases, he always struggled with how much to tell his wife. Divulging anything was technically an ethical violation, but every human, including lawyers, needed to confide in someone. Without fail, she provided a different perspective, especially when women were involved, and she never hesitated to argue a point. She would have some strong feelings about these latest developments in an already tragic story. Crossing into Clanton and almost home, he decided he would wait a day or so, or maybe more, before he told Carla that Kira was pregnant because she had been raped by Stuart Kofer. Just saying this to himself made his stomach churn. It was hard to imagine the raw anger that would boil in the courtroom if and when Jake detailed the sins of Stuart Kofer, a dead cop, unable to defend himself. Hannah was at a sleepover and the house was quiet. Carla was frosty because they were late, but Jake didn't care. It was Friday night. They were meeting friends. It was a casual dinner on the patio with a keg of beer. He took off his suit and changed into jeans, then sat and waited for her at the kitchen table. As he drove, she asked,
"So where have you been?"
"The Good Shepherd Bible Church, visiting with Josie and her team out there."
"That wasn't planned."
"No, it just happened. Charles McGarry came to the office at 3:30 and said they needed to talk. Said they were upset and needed some hand-holding. That's part of my job."
"You're getting stuck with this case, aren't you?"
"Feels like quicksand."
"We got another phone call about an hour ago. It's time to change the number."
"Did he give his name and address?"
"I doubt if he has an address. Probably lives under a rock. Some bizarre, rambling nut yelling into the phone. Said if that boy gets off, he won't last 48 hours on the streets. Said his lawyer won't make it for 24. So they'll kill me first." "It's not funny."
"I'm not laughing. Let's change the number."
"Are you calling Ozzy?"
"Yes. Not that it will do any good. We should continue that discussion about hiring private security."
"Or maybe you should just tell Noose that you've had enough."
"You want me to quit? I thought you were worried about Drew."
"I am worried about Drew. I'm also worried about Hannah and you and me and surviving in this very small town."
Stan Atkavage lived out by the country club in a wooded development of sprawling suburban homes built around the only golf course in the county. He ran Security Bank and held most of Jake's mortgages, as well as the brand new line of credit for the litigation expenses of the Smallwood case. Stan at first had balked at such a novel loan, as had Jake and Harry Rex, but as the case progressed, they realized they had no choice but to borrow. After three divorces and now with a fourth wife, Harry Rex's balance sheet was as unimpressive as Jake's, though he currently had only one mortgage on his home. At 51, Harry Rex was gazing at the future and worrying about it. Jake was only 37, but it seemed as though the longer he practiced law, the more money he owed. Stan was a close friend, but Jake couldn't stomach his wife, nor could Carla. Her name was Tilda, and she was from an old Jackson family, she often described as wealthy, which turned off most people in Clanton. The town was far too small for her and her expensive tastes. Seeking brighter lights, she had forced Stan to join the Tupelo Country Club, a status symbol in the area, and a luxury they struggled to afford. She also drank too much, spent too much, and kept the pressure on her husband to earn more. As a banker in a small town, Stan said little, but he had confided enough in Jake to let him know the marriage was not going well. Fortunately, when they arrived half an hour late, Tilda was already several drinks ahead and had moved beyond her customary stuffiness. There were five couples, all in their late 30s and early 40s, with kids ranging from 3 to 15. The women gathered at one end of the patio at a wine bar and talked about their children, while the men gathered at the keg and discussed other topics. First, it was the stock market, a subject that bored Jake because he didn't have the money to play it. And even if loaded with cash, he thought he knew enough to avoid it. Next, it was the rather salacious rumor that a doctor they all knew had cracked up and run off with a nurse. She was well known, too, because she was drop-dead gorgeous and one of the most lusted-after women in the county, single or married. Jake had not heard the rumor, never met the woman, didn't like the doctor, and tried to avoid the gossip. It was Carla's long-standing opinion that men, contrary to popular opinion, were worse gossips than women. Jake found it hard to disagree. He was relieved when the conversation drifted to sports, and even more pleased when Stan announced dinner. No one had mentioned the Kofor killing. They dined on smoked ribs, corn on the cob, and slaw. It was a perfect spring evening, just warm enough to eat outside on the patio and enjoy the blooming dogwoods. The 14th fairway was 50 yards away, and after a dessert of store-bought coconut pie, The five men fired up cigars and walked to the golf course for a smoke. The Masters was in full swing at Augusta National, and this dominated the talk. Nick Faldo and Raymond Floyd were battling it out, and Stan, a serious golfer, was generous with his analysis. Since he was hosting and wouldn't be driving, he was drinking too much. Jake had little experience with cigars, and even less with golf, and as he gamely listened, his mind went back to the scene at the church and the look of hopelessness and fear in young Kira's eyes. He shook it off and wanted to go home and crawl into bed. Stan, though, wanted to end the night with a digestif, a fine brandy someone had sent him. Back on the patio, he poured five generous shots, and the boys drifted over to bother the girls. Carla looked at the drink in Jake's hand and whispered, "Haven't you had enough?" "I'm okay." One couple was paying a babysitter and needed to call it a night. Another had a new puppy that was all alone. It was almost 11 p.m., Friday night, and most of them were looking forward to a late morning sleeping in. Thanks and farewells were offered and accepted, and the guests left. At the car, Jake's red sob, Carla asked, "Are you okay to drive?" "Sure, I'm fine." They got in, and she asked, "How many drinks have you had?" "I didn't know we were counting. Not enough." She gritted her teeth, looked away, and said nothing else. Jake was determined to prove his sobriety and drove slowly and carefully. "So, what did the girls talk about?" he asked, trying to break the ice.
"Usual stuff. Kids, school, mothers-in-law. You heard about Dr. Freddy and the nurse?"
"Oh, yes, all the details. I've always avoided him."
"He's a creep, but then his wife is not much better. Watch your speed."
"I'm doing just fine, Carla, thank you." Jake fumed and concentrated on the road. He turned onto a bypass east of town, and the bright lights of Clanton were just ahead. He glanced in his mirror and mumbled, "Crap, a cop." The patrol car had materialized from nowhere and was suddenly on his bumper, with blue lights flashing and a siren that could be heard for miles. Jake knew immediately that it was a county car. The town limits of Clanton were a mile away. Carla turned around in horror and saw the lights close behind.
"Why is he stopping us?" she asked.
"Hell if I know. I was under the speed limit." Jake slowed and managed to stop on a wide shoulder. "Do you have any gum?" he asked. Carla opened her purse, which in keeping with the current style was almost large enough to check in as luggage at the airport. Finding gum or breath mints in it, and in the dark, and under pressure, seemed unlikely. Fortunately, the officer was in no hurry. She found the gum, and Jake crammed two pieces into his mouth. It was Mike Nesbitt, a deputy Jake knew well. He knew all of them, didn't he? The officer shined his light inside and asked,
"Jake, can I see your license and registration, please?"
"Sure, Mike. How you doing?" Jake said as he handed them over.
"Great."
Nesbitt examined the cards and said,
"Just a minute."
He strolled back to his car and got in, just as a green Audi passed them in the center of the road. Jake wasn't positive, but he believed the car was owned by the Janeways, a couple they had just enjoyed dinner with. And since Jake had the only red Saab within 50 miles, there was little doubt as to who was getting pulled over. "Do you have any water?" he asked his wife.
"I don't normally carry water."
"Thank you."
"Did you drink too much?"
"No, I don't think so."
"How much did you drink?"
"I wasn't counting, but I was not excessive. Do I seem drunk now?" She turned away and didn't answer. The flashing lights seemed ready to burst, but thankfully, the siren had been turned off. Another car passed slowly. Jake handled at least one DUI charge each month and had been doing so for years. The great question was always, do you agree to take a breath test or do you refuse? Take or refuse? If you take the test and it registers too high, then you're guaranteed a conviction. Take it and slide just under the limit, and you go free. Refuse, and the cops automatically take you to jail. You post bond, get out, hire a lawyer, and slug it out in court, where you have a decent chance of winning. The sage advice, always given after the fact and far too late to be of any benefit, was to take the test if you'd had only a couple of drinks. If you know you're bombed, refuse and take a trip to jail. Take or refuse. As Jake sat there, trying to act as though he had no worries, he realized his hands were shaking. Which humiliation would be greater? Getting handcuffed in front of his wife and taken away? Or dealing with the aftermath of a failed test and the embarrassment of losing his driver's license? Could there even be a bar complaint? He had represented so many drunk drivers that he had lost any sympathy he might have for someone facing a weekend in jail. You drink and drive, you deserve the punishment. Now, though, with the minimum level set so low at 0.10, even a few drinks during the evening was too much. Take or refuse. Nesbitt was back. He approached with his flashlight shining into Jake's face.
Jake, have you been drinking?
Another crucial question no one was ever prepared to answer. Say yes and try to explain how little, and the officer would most certainly take the next step down the path to ruin. Say no and lie and face the consequences when he smelled the presence of alcohol. Say something like, "Hell no, I don't drink," and really irritate the officer with slurred words and a thick tongue.
"Yes, sir," Jake said. "We're returning from a dinner party, and I had some wine. Not much, though. I'm not under the influence, Mike. I'm fine. May I ask what I did wrong?"
"Swerving."
Which, as Jake well knew, could mean exactly that, or it could mean anything else, or nothing.
"Where was I swerving?" "Will you agree to take a BAC test here on the road?"
Jake was about to say yes, when more blue lights came over the hill in their direction. It was another deputy. He slowed, passed them, turned around, and parked behind Nesbitt, who left to have a chat.
"I'm not believing this," Carla said.
"Nor am I, dear. Just be cool."
"Oh, I'm cool. You have no idea how cool this makes me."
"I'd rather not fight here beside the road. Can you wait till we get home?"
"Are you going home, Jake? Or somewhere else?"
"I don't know.
I did not drink that much, I swear. I don't even feel a buzz."
Loss of license, time in jail, a stiff fine, increased insurance rates. Jake remembered the awful list of punishments he had recited to 100 clients. As a lawyer, he could always game the system, at least for first-time offenders, like himself. He could avoid jail, get some community service, cut the fine, justify his fee of $500. Minutes dragged by as the blue lights flickered silently. Another car approached, slowed for a good look, and passed. Jake promised himself that if and when he was financially able to buy a new car, it would not be an exotic Swedish thing in a bright color. It would be either a Ford or a Chevrolet. Nesbitt approached for the third time and said,
"Jake, would you please get out of the car?"
Jake nodded and told himself to take careful steps and speak clearly. The field sobriety test was designed to be flunked by all drivers, after which the police could then push hard for a breath test. Jake walked to the rear of his car, where the second deputy was waiting. It was Elton Fry, a veteran he had known for years.
"Evening, Jake,"
Fry said.
"Hello, Elton. Sorry to trouble you."
"Mike says you've been drinking."
"At dinner. Look at me, Elton. I'm obviously not drunk."
"So you'll take the test?"
"Of course I'll take it."
The two officers looked at each other and seemed uncertain as to their next move. Nesbitt said,
"Stu was a friend of mine, Jake. A great guy."
"I like Stu too, Mike. Sorry about what happened. I know it's tough for you guys."
"It's gonna be tougher if that punk gets off, Jake. Talk about rubbing salt into some pretty raw wounds."
Jake offered a sappy smile at such foolishness. At that moment, he would say just about anything to score a few points. He's not getting off. I can promise you that. Besides, I'm just handling his case on a temporary basis. The court will appoint another lawyer for the trial. Mike liked this and nodded at Fry, who extended a hand that held Jake's license and registration. Mike said,
"We called Ozzy. He told us to follow you home. Take it easy, okay?"
Jake's shoulders sagged as he exhaled. "Thanks, fellas. I owe you one."
"You owe Ozzy, Jake, not us."
He got in the car, latched his seatbelt, cranked the engine, glanced at his mirror, and ignored his wife, who appeared to be praying. As he pulled away, she asked,
"What happened?"
"Nothing. It was Mike Nesbitt and Elton Fry, and they both could tell I'm not drunk. They called Ozzy, told him so, and he said, follow us home. Everything's fine." The blue lights were turned off as the two patrol cars followed the red Saab into Clanton. Inside the car, nothing else was said. The kitchen phone showed three voicemails received during the evening. Carla was rinsing the coffee pot to prepare for the morning as Jake poured a glass of ice water and punched a button. The first call was a wrong number, some poor soul searching for takeout pizza. The second call was from a reporter in Jackson. The third call was from Josie Gamble, and as soon as Jake hit play, he wished he had not. She said,
"Hello, Jake, it's Josie, and I'm sorry to bother you at home. Really sorry, but Kira and I have been talking. It's been a long day, as you might guess, and we're sort of tired of talking. But anyway, I just want to say I'm sorry about jumping on you like that and asking you for money for an abortion. I was out of line, and I feel real bad. See you soon. Good night."
Carla was holding the coffee pot filled with water, her mouth open. Jake punched the clear button and looked at his wife. It was difficult holding client confidences when the client left secrets in recorded voicemails. "Abortion?" Carla asked. Jake took a deep breath and said, "Do we have any decaf?"
"I think so."
"Let's make a pot. I'll be up all night anyway. Between a near DUI and a pregnant 14-year-old, I won't be sleeping much."
"Kira?"
"Yes. Make the coffee and I'll tell you all about it." Chapter 19. The seat of Van Buren County was the backwater town of Chester. According to the 1980 census, its population was 4,100, a decline of about 1,000 from 1970. And there was no doubt the next headcount would be even smaller. It was half the size of Clanton, but seemed far more desolate. Clanton had a vibrant square with cafes, restaurants, busy offices, and shops of all varieties. Next door in Chester, though, half the window fronts along Main Street were boarded up and begging for tenants. Perhaps the clearest sign of economic and social decline was the fact that all but four lawyers had fled to bigger towns, several to Clanton. Back in the day, back when young Omar Noose hung out his shingle, there had been 20 lawyers in the county. Of the five courthouses in the 22nd Judicial District, Van Buren's was by far the worst. It was at least 100 years old, and its nondescript, bland design was clear proof that the county fathers could not afford an architect. It began as a sprawling three-story edifice of white clapboard with rows of tiny offices that housed everyone from the judges to the sheriffs to the assorted clerks, even the county's crop inspector. Over the decades, and back when the county saw modest growth, various annexes and additions were attached here and there like tumors, and the Van Buren County Courthouse became somewhat notorious as the ugliest in the state. There was nothing official about this distinction, and it was so judged primarily by the lawyers who came and went and hated the place. The exterior was perplexing, but the interior was downright dysfunctional. Nothing worked. The heating system barely knocked off the chill in the winter, and in the summer, the AC units gobbled electricity but produced precious little cool air. Entire systems, plumbing, electricity, security, collapsed with regularity. In spite of the complaining, the taxpayers had refused to pay for renovations. The most obvious remedy would have been to simply strike a match. But arson was still a crime. There were a few diehards who claimed to appreciate the quirkiness and character of the building, one of whom was the Honorable Omar Nuss, senior judge of the 22nd Circuit. For years, he had owned the second floor, where he ruled like a king in his large, antiquated courtroom, and practically lived in his chambers behind it. Down the hall, he maintained a smaller courtroom for quieter matters. His secretary, court reporter, and clerk had offices near his. Most locals believed that if not for Omar Nuss and his considerable influence, the building would have been razed years earlier. As he approached the age of 70, he preferred to travel less to his other four counties, though he didn't actually drive at all. Either his clerk or his court reporter handled the driving to Clanton, Smithfield, Gretna, or Temple, way over in Milburn County, almost 2 hours away. He was developing the bothersome habit of asking lawyers from those towns to come see him if they had business on off days. By law, he had no choice but to hold terms of court in all five counties, but he was proving adept at finding ways to stay at home. On Monday, Jake got the phone call asking him to see Nuss at 2 p.m. on Tuesday in chambers. All five courthouses had offices for the judges, but when Nuss said in chambers, he meant get your ass over here to lovely Chester, Mississippi. Jake explained to the judge's secretary that he had appointments Tuesday afternoon, which he did, but she informed him that His Honor would expect Jake to cancel those. And so, he drove through the quiet streets of Chester early Tuesday afternoon and was once again thankful he didn't live there. Whereas Clanton had been laid out neatly by a general after the Civil War, and its streets formed a precise grid for the most part, and the lovely courthouse sat majestically in the center of the square, Chester had somehow sprung to life in stages over the decades with little thought of symmetry or design. There was no square, no proper main street. Its business district was a collection of roads that met at odd angles and would have caused traffic nightmares had there been any traffic. The oddest part of the town was that the courthouse was not to be found within its limits. It sat alone, solitary, and seemingly ready to crumble on a state highway 2 miles east of town. 3 miles further east was the village of Sweetwater, the longtime rival of Chester. After the war, there had been precious little in the county to fight over, but the two towns managed to fester hostilities for decades. And in 1885, they could not agree on which one would be declared the county seat. There was actually some gunfire and a casualty or two. But the governor, who'd never been to Van Buren County and had no plans to visit, chose Chester. To appease the hotheads in Sweetwater, the courthouse was built beside a bayou almost halfway between the two towns. At the turn of the century, a diphtheria epidemic wiped out most of Sweetwater, and now there was nothing left but a couple of dying churches. Outside of Chester, Jake saw the courthouse sitting forlornly with cars parked around it. He could almost swear that one wing appeared to be leaning away from the central structure. He parked, went inside, and climbed the stairs to the second floor, where he found the main courtroom dark and empty. He walked through it, past the ancient dusty pews for spectators, through the bar, and then stopped to take in the faded oils of dead politicians and judges, all old white men. Everything had a layer of dust, and the waste baskets had not been emptied. He opened a door at the back and said hello to the secretary. She managed to smile and nodded toward a door off to the side. "Keep walking, he's waiting." Inside, in chambers, Judge Noose was behind his square oak desk. Neat piles of papers covered its surface and gave the impression that, as disorganized as things appeared, he could locate any document in an instant. "Come in, Jake," he said with a smile, but without getting to his feet. An ashtray big enough for pasta held half a dozen pipes, and the air was thick with their stale aroma. Two massive windows were each cracked about 8 inches. "Good afternoon, Judge," Jake said as he made his way over, stepping around a coffee table, a magazine rack stuffed with old editions, stacks of law books that belonged on shelves and not the floor, and two yellow labs that were almost as old as their owner. Jake was certain that they had been puppies when he first visited Noose over 10 years ago. The dogs and his honor had certainly aged, but everything else was timeless.
"Thanks for driving over, Jake. As you know, I had back surgery 2 months ago, and I'm still recuperating. Pretty stiff down there, you know."
Because of his gawky frame and long, sloping nose, Noose had been tagged early on with the nickname of Ichabod. It seemed to fit, and when Jake started lawyering, the nickname was so popular that everyone used it, behind his back, of course. But over time, Ichabod had lost its popularity. At the moment, though, Jake remembered something Harry Rex had said years ago.
"No one loves bad health like Ichabod Noose."
"No problem, Judge," Jake said.
"There are some issues we need to discuss," Noose said as he took a pipe, banged it on the edge of the ashtray, then hit it with a small flamethrower that almost singed his craggy eyebrows.
"Oh, really?" Jake thought. "Why else would you send for me?"
"Yes, sir. A number of issues."
Noose sucked on the stem and filled his jaws. As he exhaled, he said,
"First of all, how's Lucian? We go way back, you know."
"Yes, sir.
Lucian is, well, he's Lucian. Hasn't changed much, but is hanging around the office more." "Tell him I ask about him."
"I will." Lucian loathed Omar Noose, and Jake would never pass along the greeting.
"How's that kid doing, Mr. Gamble? Still at Whitfield?"
"Yes, sir. I speak with his counselor almost every day, and she says he's definitely dealing with trauma issues. She says he's improving a little, but the kid has a lot of damage, and not just because of the shooting. It'll take some time." It would take an hour to fully brief the judge on everything Dr. Sadie Weaver had told Jake, and they didn't have an hour. They would have the conversation later when a written report was received.
"I'd like to get him back in the jail in Clanton," Noose said, puffing.
Jake shrugged, because he had no control over Drew's incarceration. However, he had said to Dr. Weaver that his client was much better off in a juvenile wing than in a county jail.
"You can talk to them, Judge. You send him down there, and I'm sure his doctors would talk to you." "I might do that."
He put the pipe down and clasped his hands behind his head.
"I gotta tell you, Jake, I can't get anyone else to take the case. God knows I've tried."
He suddenly reached over, picked up a legal pad, and tossed it to the front of his desk as if Jake was supposed to have a look.
"I've called 17 lawyers. Names are all right there. Hell, you know most of them. 17 lawyers with capital experience from all over the state. I've talked to all of them on the phone, Jake, and some more than others. I begged, pleaded, cajoled, and I would have threatened, but I have no jurisdiction outside the 22nd. You know that, and nothing, not a one, nobody, is willing to step up. I've called all the nonprofits, the Children's Capital Defense Fund, the Juvenile Justice Initiative, the ACLU, and others. The names are all right there. They are very sympathetic and would like to help, and may indeed help, but right now, Nobody can spare a trial lawyer to defend this kid. You have any ideas?
No, but you promised, Judge.
I know that, and I meant it. But at the time, I was desperate. I'm in charge of the judicial system in these parts, Jake, and it all fell on me to make sure this kid was taken care of legally. You know what I went through. I had no choice. You were man enough to step up when everybody else was hiding under their desks and running from the phone. Now, I'm asking you to keep it, Jake. Keep this case and make sure this defendant gets a fair trial.
Obviously, you plan to deny my motion to move it to youth court.
Of course. I'm keeping jurisdiction for a lot of reasons, Jake. If he goes through youth court, he'll be out when he's 18. You think that's fair?
No, not in theory. Not at all.
Good, then we agree. He stays in circuit court, and you're his lawyer.
But, Judge, I'm not going to let this case bankrupt me. I practice alone and have a limited staff. So far, since your first phone call on March 25th, I've spent 41 hours on this case, and the work has just begun. As you know, the state legislature caps attorney's fees in indigent cases at $1,000. Hard to believe, Judge, but a fee of $1,000 for a capital defense is a joke. I have to get paid, Judge.
I'll make sure you get paid.
But how, Judge? The statute is pretty clear.
I know. Believe me, I understand, Jake. It's an outrageous law, and I've written letters to our lawmakers. I have an idea. Something that's never been done, at least not in the 22nd. You keep up with your hours, and when the case is over, you submit a bill to the county. When the supervisors refuse to pay, then sue them in circuit court. I'll handle the case, and I'll rule in your favor. How about that?
It's definitely a novel idea. Never heard of it.
It'll work because I'll make it work. We'll have a quick trial with no jury, and I'll see that you get paid.
But that's months away.
That's the best we can do, Jake. The law is the law.
So I'll get $1,000 now and pray for the rest.
It's the best we can do.
What about experts?
What about them?
Come on, Judge. The state will have all manner of shrinks and mental health professionals at its disposal to testify.
Are you implying an insanity defense?
No, I'm not implying anything. I still can't believe I'm getting stuck with the damn case.
And the family has no money.
Are you serious? They're homeless. They're wearing second and third-hand clothing. Their relatives, wherever they are, washed their hands years ago. And they'd be starving right now if not for the generosity of a church.
Okay, just had to ask. I figured as much. I'll do what I can, Jake, to make sure you get paid.
That's not good enough, Judge. I want a promise from you that I'll get paid a lot more than $1,000.
I promise I'll do everything within my power to see that you get paid for a proper defense.
Jake took a deep breath and told himself that it was time to accept the fact that the gamble case belonged to him. Noose fiddled with another pipe and stuffed its bowl full of dark tobacco. He grinned at Jake with his brown teeth and said,
"I'll sweeten the pot."
"Smallwood?"
"Smallwood. I'll set a trial date a week from next Monday, April 23rd. I won't put up with Sean Gilder's nonsense and will insist that we're picking a jury bright and early that morning. I'll call Gilder and Walter Sullivan within the hour. How's that?"
"Thank you."
"Are you ready for trial, Jake?"
"I've been ready."
"Any chance of a settlement?"
"Right now, that appears unlikely."
"I want you to win this case, Jake. Don't get me wrong, I will remain an unbiased referee whose job is to guarantee a fair trial. But I'd love to see you pop Gilder and Sullivan and that railroad for a big verdict."
"So would I, Judge. I need it." Noose puffed and chewed on the stem. He said,
"You and I are not very popular right now, Jake.
judging by this stack of letters I've received from Ford County, and from phone calls, some anonymous, some not. They think we've already found the boy insane and let him off. Are you worried about this during jury selection? Well, yes. Harry Rex and I have discussed it. He's more worried than I am, because I still believe we can find 12 jurors with open minds.
So do I. We'll take our time and screen them carefully. Let's bring the boy back from Whitfield so the hotheads will know he's back in jail, awaiting trial and not getting released on some technicality. I think that'll appease some folks. You agree?
Jake said yes, but wasn't sure he meant it. Noose had a point. If Drew was back in Ozzie's jail and awaiting trial, the locals might settle down.
Noose said, I'll call the clerk and get the jury list released tomorrow. I think 100 names should suffice, don't you?
Yes, sir. 100 was about average for a civil trial. Noose took his time cleaning another pipe. He carefully added more tobacco, lit the pipe, savored the smoke, then stood, unfolding his lanky frame out of the chair with some effort. He walked to a window and gazed out, as if taking in a beautiful landscape. Without turning around, he said, over his shoulder,
Something else, Jake. Something off the record, okay?
He seemed burdened with an unpleasant thought.
Sure, Judge.
I once made a living as a politician and was quite good at it. Then the voters called me home, and I had to go clean and make an honest living. I've worked hard as a judge, and I'd like to think I've grown into this job. Been here for 18 years. Never had a serious opponent. My reputation is pretty solid, right, Jake?
He turned around and looked down his long nose. I'd say it's very solid, Judge.
Noose sucked on his pipe and watched the smoke swirl near the ceiling. I have come to despise judicial elections. Politics should be kept out of the judiciary at all levels. I know that's easy for me to say because I've been on the bench for a long time. Incumbency has its advantages. But it's sort of unseemly for judges to be forced to shake hands and kiss babies and hustle for votes. Don't you agree, Jake?
Yes, sir. It's a bad system. As bad as it seemed, the truth was that judges were rarely challenged and almost never defeated. Most ambitious lawyers considered it financial suicide to run against a sitting judge and lose. Jake suspected Rufus Buckley was very much on Noose's mind. He said,
It appears as though I'll have an opponent next year.
I've heard the rumors.
Your old pal, Buckley.
I still despise him, Judge. I guess I always will.
He blamed me for the Haley acquittal. Blamed you, blamed everyone but himself. He's been stewing for 5 years, plotting revenge. When he lost the DA's race 3 years ago, he became so depressed he had to seek help, at least according to my sources in Smithfield. Now he's back, and he's running his mouth. Thinks the public needs him sitting on the bench in my chair. Last Friday at the Rotary Club, he babbled on about the Cofer case. Said you had hoodwinked the court again and convinced me to release the boy.
I'm not worried about the Rotary Club gossip in Smithfield, Judge.
Of course not, but your name won't be on the ballot there, now will it?
Judge, look. The last time Buckley ran, he lost 4 out of 5 counties, and Lowell Dyer was an unknown.
I know. It wasn't close.
Jake was surprised that the conversation had shifted so quickly from business to politics. Noose had never let his guard down and become so personal. He was obviously worried about a campaign that was months away and might never happen. Jake said, Ford County has more voters than the other four, and your reputation there is stellar. The bar is solidly behind you for all the right reasons, and the bar utterly loathes Rufus Buckley. You'll be in good shape, Judge. Noose returned to his desk and added the pipe to the collection in the pasta bowl. He did not sit down but rubbed his hands together as if to say, Done.
Thanks, Jake. Let's keep an eye on Buckley.
Jake stood and said, Will do. I'll see you early in the morning a week from Monday. They shook hands, and Jake left in a hurry. In his car, he called Harry Rex, bluffed his way past two rude secretaries, and finally delivered the wonderful news that a trial date was set, and they would know the names of the potential jurors within 24 hours. Harry Rex bellowed loud enough for his entire office to hear, then cackled into the phone, "I've already got the list!" Chapter 20. A sizable chunk of the funds from the litigation loan at Stan's bank had been used to pay the fee of a fancy jury consultant named Murray Seilerberg. He owned a firm based in Atlanta and boasted of securing huge verdicts for the past 20 years. Jake had heard him speak at a convention of trial lawyers and was mightily impressed. Harry Rex didn't want to spend the money and claimed he could pick a jury better than anyone else in the state. Jake had to remind his friend that he had not picked a jury in 10 years because he realized back then that jurors didn't like him. They had spent a day driving to Atlanta to meet Murray Seilerberg, after which Harry Rex reluctantly got on board. The fee was a flat $20,000 plus travel expenses. Jake made the call to Stan and said, "Hit the credit line." Stan once again told him he was crazy, to which Jake replied in true trial lawyer fashion, "Gotta spend money to make money." It was true. Litigation loans were becoming popular across the country, and trial lawyers, ever eager to brag about their verdicts, had begun bragging about how much they borrowed and spent convincing juries. Seilerberg's firm studied every civil verdict in the country, with a special interest in the Deep South and Florida. Most of their clients and verdicts were close to home. A partner followed verdicts in urban areas, while Seilerberg was fascinated with small towns and counties where the juries were much more conservative. When he got the green light from Jake, he immediately began polling rural voters in North Mississippi to gauge their attitudes about courts, lawyers, and lawsuits. The polling was extensive and included hypothetical cases involving parents and children killed in auto accidents. At the same time, an investigative team working for Seilerberg began digging through the backgrounds of the names on the Golden List. The Smallwood suite had been a large, empty storage space for years, but when Jake filed suit 13 months earlier, it was converted to a war room. The investigators took it over and were soon thumbtacking sheets of paper and enlarged photos on all four walls. Photos of the homes, trailers, apartments, cars, trucks, and places of employment of the prospective jurors. They dug through land records, court filings, and dockets, anything that was in the public domain. They were careful and tried not to be seen, but several prospective jurors complained later that they saw strangers with cameras in their neighborhoods. Of the 97 names, 8 were soon confirmed to be dead. Jake knew only 7 of those still living, and as he studied the list, he once again marveled at how few names he recognized. He had lived his entire life in Ford County, population 32,000, and thought he had a lot of friends. Harry Rex claimed to know something about 20 of the potential jurors. The early polling was less than encouraging. Not surprisingly, Murray Seilerberg knew that juries in the rural South are suspicious of big verdicts and tight with money, even when it belonged to large corporations. It was extremely difficult to convince hardworking people to hand over $1 million when they were living from paycheck to paycheck. Jake was well aware of this. He had never asked a jury for 7 figures, but even so, he had been burned. A year earlier, he got a bit carried away and demanded $100,000 from a jury in a case that was worth less than half of that. A split jury gave him only $26,000, and the case was on appeal. Harry Rex watched the closing arguments and thought Jake alienated some of the jurors by asking for too much. The lawyers and their high-priced consultant knew the dangers of appearing greedy. Privately, though, Jake and Harry Rex were delighted with the list. There were more prospects under the age of 50 than over it, and that should translate into younger parents with more sympathy. Old white jurors were the most conservative. The county was 26% black, and so was the list, a high number. In most white counties, blacks registered to vote in lower numbers. They were also known to be more sympathetic for the little guy battling the corporation, and Harry Rex claimed to know two ringers, men who could be persuaded to see things the plaintiff's way. The mood around Jake's office changed dramatically. Gone were the worries about defending Drew Gamble and dealing with that tragedy. They were quickly replaced with the excitement of a major trial and the endless preparations for it. But the Gamble case was not going away. For reasons having more to do with overcrowding than proper care, Drew needed to leave Whitfield. After 18 days, his doctor, Sadie Weaver, was ordered to ship him back to Clanton because his bed was needed by another juvenile. She telephoned Judge Noose, Jake, and Sheriff Walls. Ozzie was delighted to get the kid back in his jail and tipped off Dumas Lee at the Ford County Times. When the defendant arrived in the back seat of a patrol car driven by the sheriff himself, Dumas was waiting and clicked away. The following day, a large photo appeared on the front page under the bold headline, "Cofer Suspect Back in Clanton Jail." Dumas reported that, according to Lowell Dyer, the district attorney, the defendant had been served with his indictment and they were awaiting a first appearance in court. No trial date had been set. Jake was quoted as offering a no comment. Same for Judge Noose. An unnamed source, Jake, told Dumas that it was not at all unusual in serious cases to have the defendant examined at Whitfield. Another anonymous voice predicted a trial by midsummer. At 8 a.m. on Saturday, Jake met a group of people at the rear door of the courthouse, which was closed for business. Using a borrowed key, he unlocked it and herded them up a service stairway to the main courtroom where the lights were on and his team was waiting. He seated them, 13 in all, in the jury box and then introduced Harry Rex, Lucian Wilbanks, Portia Lang, and Murray Seilerberg, and one of his assistants. The courtroom was locked, and of course, there were no spectators. He called 13 names, thanked them for their time, and passed out 13 checks of $300 each, another $3,900 from their litigation loan. He explained that mock juries were often used in big civil cases, and he hoped the experience would be pleasant. The mock trial would consume most of the day, and there would be a nice lunch in just a few hours. Of the 13, 7 were women, 4 were black, and 5 were under the age of 50. They were friends and former clients of Jake's and Harry Rex's. One of the black ladies was Portia's aunt. Lucian assumed his place up on the bench, and for a moment seemed to enjoy being a judge. Harry Rex moved to the defense table. Jake began the trial with a scaled-down version of his opening statement. Everything would be scaled down for the sake of time. They had one day to complete the mock trial. The real one was expected to last for at least 3. On a large screen, he showed color photos of Taylor and Sarah Smallwood and their 3 children and talked about how close the family was. He showed photos of the crash scene, the demolished car, and the train. A state trooper had returned to the site the following day and taken a series of photos of the warning lights. Jake showed them to the jurors, and several shook their heads in disbelief at the badly maintained system. Wrapping it up, Jake planted the seed for a big verdict by discussing money. He explained that, unfortunately, in death cases, the only measure of damages was money. In other cases, the defendants could be forced to take remedial action, but not here. There was no other way to compensate the Smallwood heirs than with a money verdict. Harry Rex, for the first and last time in his career in the role of an insurance defense lawyer, went next with his opening statement and began dramatically with a large color photo of the 14th boxcar, the one struck by the Smallwoods. It was 15 feet high and 40 feet long, and it was equipped, like all railroad cars, with a set of reflective strips that, when hit with headlights, emitted a bright yellow glow that could be seen for 300 yards. No one would ever know what Taylor Smallwood saw or didn't see in that final crucial second. But what he should have seen was quite obvious. As a defense lawyer, Harry Rex was good, sufficiently dubious of the plaintiff's case, and most of the jurors followed him closely. The first witness was Hank Grayson, played by Murray Seilerberg's assistant, Nate Feathers. 8 months earlier, Mr. Grayson had been deposed in Jake's office, and he swore under oath that he was about 100 yards behind the Smallwoods when the crash occurred. For a split second, he wasn't sure what happened, and by the time he hit his brakes, he almost hit their car, which had gone airborne and spun 180 degrees. The train was still moving by. Most important, the red warning lights were not flashing. Jake had always worried about Grayson. He believed the man was telling the truth. He had nothing to gain by lying. But he was timid, could not maintain eye contact, and had a squeaky voice. In other words, he did not project veracity. Plus, on the night in question, he had been drinking. Harry Rex pounced on this during cross-examination. Grayson stuck to his story of